Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara,
and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
The all right. Now, what you're going to hear right now is Secretary Mattis, okay, and then you're going to hear Harris Holman. So this might be about 45 minutes, but it's awesome though. So after he gave his speech that you heard yesterday, this is called the Shangri-La Dialogue, and it focuses Asia Pacific security. And you can imagine what the topics are. So if we're talking Asia-Pacific security, what are the topics? Topics are China. The topics are the South China Sea. The topics are the importance of the Indo-Pacific shipping lines and keeping them open, free, and governed by the rule of law and not the fiat of a communist dictatorship. And so the Chinese get it stuffed in their face, this whole security event, this whole event, they get it put in their face. So anyway, and they did not attend with their Joint Chiefs of Staff guy, right? Their version of Joe Dunford, he did not show up because he didn't want to take pie in the face after pie in the face after pie in the face. So, but this is awesome though. Secretary Mattis taking questions at the Shangri-La dialogue. So here's our guy, I think he's Australian, who's hosting it. And then the Secretary of Defense takes over. So don't touch that dial, honestly. This is great stuff.
Mr. Secretary, and happily we have a good amount of time for questions. I've got 8 or 9 people on the list already. Tap your name badge, press the green touchscreen, press the silver button. You'll be on my list. The first person to catch my eye is Josh Rogan from the U.S. Josh.
Thank you very much. Mr. Secretary, thank you for your time today and for your service. As the Trump administration tries to strengthen our alliances and partnerships to implement what your own national defense strategy calls our strategic competition with China, the way in which the Trump administration is picking fights with allies and partners, for example on trade, but certainly not exclusively on trade, seems profoundly counterproductive. If one of China's strategic aims is to separate the United States from its allies and partners, aren't we doing their work for them? Thank you.
Well, first of all, I would just tell you that when I travel the region, we find a great deal of common purpose with our partners, with our allies, even with non-traditional partners and allies, new relationships that are coming afresh to us that were not ones that we enjoyed as short as 5 years ago or 10 years ago. So in the reality of what I find as I travel, the short answer is no, we are not. Now, there are areas where friends disagree. There are areas where we compete in trade. But there is an underlying basis, a fundamental respect for certain values. And I would just say those values were extremely well articulated last evening by the Prime Minister of India when he spoke about respect for international law, that sort of thing. There was a president that we had a few years ago that I referenced earlier, President Thomas Jefferson. And he made a statement that in something so complicated as the science of what he called political economy, no one axiom can be laid down as wise and expedient for all times and circumstances. Certainly, we have had some unusual approaches. I'll be candid with you, some unusual approaches to how we deal with these issues. But I'm reminded that so long as nations continue dialogues, so long as they continue to listen to one another and to pay respect to one another, nothing's over based on one decision one day. And the enduring sharing of values, the enduring respect, always provides a forum for us to move a relationship forward in a positive manner. And again, I would repeat, in a positive manner, a positive direction.
From Indonesia, Dr.
Pretty slick, right? So he's talking about, you know, trade wars and tariffs and whatnot and the friction. And Mattis answers it in a way that emphasizes we have, you know, 95% of our relationship sees the same thing. We have 5% that we disagree with. It's not a big thing. And then he quotes Jefferson. He gets better in all this. He's awesome.
Sylvia Yazid.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Secretary. When we are talking about strategic partnership in this region, of course, we also have to deal with gaps of capabilities. May we know what U.S. have the strategies for to deal with these gaps in capabilities among nations in this region? Thank you.
You know, as we look at this issue, it's one that we confronted inside the strategy, because too often we've seen the very gap you refer to actually set us apart from allies, from partners, from those who are dealing with terrorism, for example, or other transnational threats. And what you have to do when you're in our position, you have to adjust everything from your training to the liaison opportunities to the education opportunities, and use education and training as the primary avenues to close those gaps. I think that what we will see in the future is I direct a by, with, and through military strategy for the U.S. military and Indo-Pacific Command. You're going to see us more capable of closing that gap from our end, where before we stood back, said this is the way we do business. Now we're going to come to you, say, how do you do business? And here's what we've learned, whether it be in combating terrorism or in maritime operations, and share those lessons in a manner that can be embraced, and then we assist you also with high-end capabilities, if that's what the gap is based on, and bring you forward as your sovereign decisions say this is a priority for you. So we believe the gap can be closed, and it really comes down to whether or not we have the political will and the military wisdom to close the gap. If we know the gap can be closed, we all recognize that. It's just whether or not we choose to do so. I'm quite confident we can close the gap as we go forward. We do not find any military out here that is somehow in a position where they cannot grow and we cannot grow alongside them in terms of partnership. We can overcome the gaps.
And from India, Sheila Bhatt.
Thank you. I wanted to ask, America has changed name of Pacific Command recently to U.S. Pacific Command. Sir, I wanted to know, what does it signify? What is the symbolism in it?
Right. With the symbolism, I've been asked about that.
Okay. The question she asked was about the renaming of the U.S. Pacific Command, Indo-PACOM. So that's the question.
Several times last night and this morning. The bottom line is we should be willing to adapt the name of the command to reflect more accurately its focus. And as we look right now at the role of the Indian Ocean, with the largest democracy in the world coming into its own with economic progress there in India, we need to recognize that there's a growing significance to the Indian Ocean, to the Indian subcontinent, and certainly to India itself. So I want to make certain that the title actually reflects the reality. And there's a changing reality. The world's always changing, and that's all this was. Now, underneath that, there are things that have been going on which show, as I referenced in my prepared remarks, that we are, in fact, dealing with our priority theater. I don't trumpet those things. We've replaced, for example, third-generation fighters with fifth-generation fighters. We've added our most capable ships to the commander of Indo-Pacific Command's fleet during the last year or two. And we will continue to address this theater as a priority and properly defined as now the Indo-Pacific command.
And from China, Senior Colonel Zhao Zhu.
From China, this ought to be good, right?
Thank you. A couple of years ago, the United States sent the Antietam missile cruiser and the Hawkins missile destroyer to China's territorial waters. And I think it is a violation of the law of the People's Republic of China.
Notice he says the laws of the People's Republic of China, not international law. These guys are such assholes. Really? When you think of Chinese and Russians, it's just like they're assholes. We're not perfect, but they're like walking sphincter muscles.
On territorial waters and the contiguous zone. And also, it is obvious provocation to China's national security and territorial integrity. I think it is the militarization in the South China Sea under the name of the freedom of navigation. So I'd like to have your comment on this.
Yeah, Colonel, I think it goes to a fundamental disconnect between the way the international tribunals have looked at these waters. These waters to us are free and open international waters. We all talk about a free and open Pacific, a free and open Asia Pacific, a free and open Indo-Pacific. Freedom means freedom for all nations, large and small, to transit international airspace, international waters. Traditionally, historically, and by the rule of law, this is not a revisionist view. This is a traditional view. This is an established view, and we've had international tribunals reinforce this. Independent from us, that we don't control it. It was under UNCLOS. And so when we see those kind of manifestations of interpretations of international law, then we...
UNCLOS is United Nations Commission on Law of the Sea, if I'm not mistaken. He's like taking this guy to school. Why this guy would tee this question up for him so that he could get educated in public on what the law of the sea is with Secretary Mattis, right? One of the largest brains in the room is beyond me.
Act accordingly. We do not do freedom of navigation for America alone. We do freedom of navigation. It's freedom for all nations, large and small, that need to transit those waters for their own prosperity. And they have every reason to do so. So we do not see it as a militarization by going through what has traditionally been an international water space. What we see it as is a reaffirmation of the rules-based order. And I will be going to Beijing to have further discussions on this at your government's invitation here at the end of the month. But I understand the disagreement, but it is not one on which we are unstudied, and we believe it's only appropriate that we keep those waterways open for all nations.
And from Thailand, Dr. Thamsak Chalem Palunapap.
Talk about getting them busted off in your ass in public. Why would we tee that up for that guy? Okay. The colonel needs to get counseled. Okay. That's not really what we wanted to have happen. All right. He continues. He's awesome.
You may have turned off your microphone, I fear, so go ahead. I'm afraid you've turned off your microphone, so perhaps I'll just go to someone else and come back to you when someone comes to sort that out. Mark Champion from the UK.
Secretary, thank you. I think it's clear that you have established this year, last year, and for some time, agreement on those principles of the rules-based order, freedom of navigation, among most of the allies who come here. There's an increasing question, I think, about whether, not to mix metaphors, but the ship has sailed. In other words, the military assets that you were protesting against and their placement on islands that have already been built, they're there, they're not going to move, and the role that China, whatever role it is that China seeks to use them for, is going to continue. Do you think that in essence, it's correct that ship has sailed and you're going to have to deal with it?
Well, I think that dealing with it is a reality. I think there are consequences to China ignoring the international community. We firmly believe in the non-coercive aspects of how nations should get along with each other, that they should listen to each other. Nothing wrong with competition, nothing wrong with having strong positions, but when it comes down to introducing what they have done in the South China Sea, there are consequences. I would tell you that up until, if you'd asked me 2 months ago, I'd have said we are still attempting to maintain a cooperative stance with the PRC, with China. We are inviting them to the RIMPAC, the world's largest naval exercise, in order to try to keep the open lines of military communication between us and transparency. But when you look at what President Xi said in the Rose Garden of the White House in 2015, that they would not militarize the Spratlys, and then we watched what happened 4 weeks ago, it was time to say there's a consequence to this, and the world's largest naval exercise will not have the Chinese Navy participating. But that's a relatively small consequence. I believe there are much larger consequences in the future when nations lose the rapport of their neighbors, when they believe that piling mountainous debts on their neighbors and somehow removing the freedom of political action is the way to engage with them. Eventually, these things do not pay off, even if on the financial ledger sheet or the power ledger sheet they appear to. It's a very shaky foundation when we believe that militarizing features are somehow going to endorse their standing in the world and enhance it. It is not. It's not going to be endorsed in the world. It's not going to enhance it. And you have to wonder why military actions that are politically injurious would be engaged in by a nation. What is the value to having carried out military operations? Number one, we all know nobody is ready to invade those features. Certainly we could have had the dispute resolution go on in a peaceful way. To simply muscle the way in using weapons to do what international tribunals do not endorse is not a way to make long-term collaboration the rule of the road in a region that's as important to China's future, and we respect that, as it is to every other nation's future out here. So there are consequences that will continue to come home to roost, so to speak, with China if they do not find a way to work more collaboratively with all of the nations who have interests.
Dr. Tamsak.
Nice. He's very eloquent. And it does it with without being too provocative, but he talks, and you can see why around the world he's incredibly respected. We understand China's perspective, but international law says this. We understand China's perspective, but listen to how many times he uses the word coercive. Pretty interesting. Again, he's in his element here, and he crushes it, and you can see why they like him. At one point, he gets applause for something. I can't remember what he says.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Secretary, what else can ASEAN do as far as the FOIP is concerned?
ASEAN, right? The Asian Southeast Alliance, the Alliance of Southeast Asian Nations, something like that. Australia, Thailand, Vietnam, Philippines, Malaysia, Burma, blah, 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 blah. Okay, that's who that is. So that alliance down there that does not include China.
So far, ASEAN as a group is only asking for more details. So in your opinion, what else can ASEAN as a group do?
Number one, we see ASEAN centrality in effect being a way to have a forum where the nations can come together. And certainly some nations are small. They don't have big militaries. They have smaller economies. But they all have a voice. They all have human beings who deserve a future and need prospects of advantage. This is the normal thing that nations do for their people. It's why, frankly, we're all here at Shangri-La. I mean, we wouldn't be here if we didn't recognize our interactions with each other. I think when you look at ASEAN, it has always been a very non-contentious organization. It looks for ways to deal with things maturely. How do you make things win-win rather than win-lose? How can everybody benefit? Now, when they speak with one voice, there is a much stronger lesson coming out of ASEAN, a lesson that we can all learn from. I think, too, that we have to avoid, I would just point out what Prime Minister Modi called last night, the impossible burdens of debt. Certain nations can actually lose their freedom simply by taking what appears to be a hand up, when in fact it's a hand out that makes them dependent.
Now, this is a reference to the Belt and Road Initiative of China, right? And Mattis's admonition to everybody is that there's better ways to do this. Well, you don't have to assume all that debt. With China foreclosing on that and taking over your port and yanking concessions out of you. Grant Newsham has talked about it, that the Chinese are not, they don't forgive debt, right? We'll come in and we'll do this, but you'll pay for it. And should you default on it for whatever reason, we'll take it over, we'll do this, we'll do that. So that's what, without saying Belt and Road, that's what he's talking about here.
So if the ASEAN nations can help one another and support one another in a way that maintains the freedom, the sovereignty, the territorial integrity of each of the nations, then that, in effect, strengthens ASEAN's voice. But I think it's most important that ASEAN look for unity on these fundamental values that Prime Minister Modi went into quite good detail about last night. And the idea that we're going to turn over this world to our children without having the same kinds of values, the same advantages that we have enjoyed as these nations came out from underneath the yoke of colonialism, I think that's a very irresponsible position. We're going to have to pull together and deal with it in a unified way. ASEAN centrality means it is fundamental to that effort.
And from France, François Bourg.
Thank you. Last year at the previous Shangri-La dialogue, in response to a question from the floor, sir, you urged America's allies, I quote, to bear with us, end of quote. Does this recommendation still stand? And on a more personal note, how are you bearing up?
I hate it when someone quotes me from the year before.
Never happens.
I would just tell you that based on my travels over the last year, I've been out in the region 6 times since I was last here, some for extended trips. And I enjoy doing a lot of listening when I'm out and about. We continue to find more common ground than uncommon ground. We continue to find more reasons for collaboration than not. And remember, this is an America that if you go back several hundred years to President Jefferson, from then on, we saw this as an opportunity out in the Pacific to stand with nations. Our first treaty of amity was with Thailand back in the early 1800s. For 200 years, we've been here. For 200 years, we've watched the European colonial wave come through and then recede. We have watched fascism, imperialism, wash over the region, and at a great cost to many of us in this room and our forefathers, it was pushed back and defeated by 1945. We watched Soviet communism as it tried to push into the region, and the Cold War blunted, stopped, and rolled that back. So we have been here, we have seen those who want to dominate the region come and watch them go, and we've stood with you. So this is not about one decision at this point in time. This is not about areas that we may find uncommon right now, and we may be dealing with in unusual ways. But the bottom line is that we have been through thick and thin. We have stood with nations, and they all recognize today we believe in the free and independent and sovereign nations out here. And I would just tell you that we are not going to change our mind on this. After that rather nasty argument we had with King George III, my apologies to our UK comrades, we have stood on this same principle, and it's not based on which party's in power. It is not based on a fleeting position. This is one we look back on with a great deal of confidence. So
now he takes this and he'll turn it towards China now.
Oh, I also look forward to the future with confidence, and I'm doing just fine. Thank you. No problem.
Well done.
Yeah. And from Japan, Hiroyuki Akita.
Thank you very much, Chairman. Hiroyuki Akita from Nikkei, Japan. I have two quick questions about the North Korean crisis. One is that in late April, as I remember, you implied that the status of U.S. troops in Korean Peninsula will be on the negotiation table if peace talk between South and North will make a progress. And does it mean that it is also option for U.S. to withdraw or reduce U.S. military footprint in Korean Peninsula in case of the, you know, if there was a progress between South and North peace talks? And second question is that President Trump announced that there's going to be a meeting on June 12th between Mr. Trump and Mr. Kim Jong-un. And he said that he doesn't want to talk about the maximum pressure anymore. And so my question is that, is military options still on the table? Or while you talk, U.S. talk with North Korea, maybe it is off the table. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Obviously, the eyes of the world, the hopes of the world are on these talks. And I would just say to our Singapore hosts here today, they are also hosting these talks, and we are grateful that you have been able to, on such short notice, with the usual to and fro of something as historically groundbreaking as this, the way you've just taken it all in stride, we are grateful for that sort of support. I would tell you that any discussion about the number of U.S. troops in the Republic of Korea is subject to, one, the Republic of Korea's invitation to have them there, and the discussions between the United States and the Republic of Korea, separate and distinct from the negotiations that are going on with DPRK. That issue will not come up in the discussions with DPRK. And as you all recognize, those troops are there as a recognition of a security challenge. Obviously, if the diplomats can do their work, if we can reduce the threat, if we can restore confidence-building measures with something verifiable, then, of course, these kinds of issues can come up subsequently between two sovereign democracies, the Republic of Korea and the United States. But that issue is not on the table here in Singapore on the 12th, nor should it be. As far as military options, I think you're aware, and I said this last year when I was here, I have said it in every public forum when I've been asked about this issue. This has been a diplomatically led issue since January 22nd of last year when we came into office. It has been diplomatically led. It has been diplomatically reinforced at the UN Security Council. with three, just since January of last year, three unanimous Security Council resolutions. It was diplomatically led when Canada hosted the sending nation's foreign ministers. These are the nations that sent troops to the Korean Peninsula in response to the United Nations call in 1950. Canada hosted the foreign ministers, not the defense ministers, at Vancouver, British Columbia, in a discussion this last January to further the diplomatic efforts to try to bring this issue to close. So we still stand for the verifiable and irreversible denuclearization of the peninsula, and the diplomats are engaged right now in New York. Their advance teams are engaged here in Singapore, and I think the hopes of all of us lie with them.
And from Australia, Gordon Flake.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Over the last several months, there's been a lot of discussion about the quadrilateral dialogue between the United States, Japan, Australia, and India, and so much so that it's been a bit of a straw man thrown up there as evidence of the lack of robustness of the Indo-Pacific. And yet, in your remarks and in the Prime Minister's remarks last night, the Quad didn't come up in specific. I'm curious as to your assessment of the relationship between the Quad itself and the Indo-Pacific strategy as you've outlined it.
Very good. The Quad, as you characterize it accurately, is certainly one of those additional mechanisms, multilateral mechanisms, that we look to. We look to it to be, and look at what is the common character there. Australia, Japan, and India, and the United States. All four are democracies. That's the first thing that jumps out at you. So we have four democracies that are talking about how do we maintain stability. How do we maintain open navigation? How do we talk about basically keeping things on a peaceful dispute resolution path? And I think that it's absolutely an idea fit for its time, and I support it 100%. I actually had my seven-hour speech here, and that was one of the things I cut out in order to reduce it somewhat.
From the United States, Senator Dan Sullivan.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary, for an outstanding speech and your exceptional leadership. We in the U.S. Senate also think you're doing fine, so I'm glad you think you're doing fine. You know, as the Secretary of Defense, you've also spoken very articulately about the importance of economic issues and financial issues. And in addition to your leadership, where we are very focused on rebuilding our military, we are also back home in the United States reinvigorating very strongly our economy, hoping to be growing at 3 to 4% GDP growth, which we haven't seen in well over a decade, and areas like energy, where we are now once again the world's energy superpower in terms of the production of oil, production of natural gas, production of renewables. Can you talk to those issues and how you see them fitting in the broader Indo-Pacific strategy for the United States and how important those are, as well as military matters?
I can, Senator. One of our senators from a Pacific ocean state of the state of Alaska, the economy of our country has always been the economic engine that drove our national security. So restoring the economic underpinnings has been essential as the administration came into office with its responsibilities. But we see this almost as the way we hear it explained to us every time we get on an airliner. You've all heard the speech that in the event of loss of cabin pressure, your mask will drop, put your own mask on first, and then help others around you. We see what we're doing here as a way to economically build our own enduring strength, but we do not see that, nor have we ever seen that, as something selfish. You know what we did with the Marshall Plan after World War II. Senator Gardner also joins us here. He has got an initiative with heavy bipartisan support in the U.S. Senate, the House of Representatives, for the Asia reassurance, basically, how are we going to reinforce our friends, partners, allies in the Pacific? How do we share that kind of economic vitality that we are going to have in terms of technology, in terms of military, the military connection, and most importantly, how do we help the development of those nations that are still lagging behind or still coming out of difficult circumstance? So this is basically our engine again today that has been ever since around 1900 that kept us as an arsenal of freedom, an arsenal of democracy. But it's also meant in the broader terms of democratic values being reinforced by using the economic sinews that we are now developing once again in a much more robust manner, if that addresses your question, Senator.
And from Pakistan, Ali Sarwar Naqvi.
Mr. Secretary, it's a pleasure to hear you speak about U.S. strategy in the Pacific region. Mr. Secretary, I head a think tank in Islamabad, Pakistan. There are perceptions that different people have about different things. We feel that the United States is, of course, interested in peace and stability of the South Asian region, but is not paying enough attention to the nuclear situation in our region. The nuclear weapons capability of India and Pakistan on land was worrying in many ways already, and now India has embarked upon the nuclearization of the Indian Ocean with the Arihant and the Brahmos and all other naval vessels, submarines, nuclear-powered and nuclear-armed submarines, which is not only a cause of a strategic instability in the between India and Pakistan. It's also a security worry for 32 littoral states that are all located in the Indian Ocean region. Would you like to comment, sir, on this? And I have another small question, if I can quickly do it, Mr. Chairman.
If you can quickly do it.
The Indian role in Afghanistan. India is not a neighbor or contiguous to Afghanistan. So I don't know how U.S. visualizes an Indian role in Afghanistan. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Very good questions. We put together several strategies, and one common theme in our Indo-Pacific strategy, and certainly in what we called our South Asia strategy, which was the one that within which we contribute to the NATO-led campaign in Afghanistan, a theme is these are not exclusive strategies. These are not confrontational strategies. They are based on the idea of cooperation. For example, we regionalized our strategy in South Asia, so we were not looking at Afghanistan in isolation. And obviously, when you look at South Asia, then Pakistan and India were two of the nations we had to consider their legitimate security interests, their potential role in restoring peace in an area where a war has gone on too long already. And so we put these strategies together as a way to find common ground regionally, not as a way to find an exclusive club. So in terms of narrow that down to non-proliferation, I believe that we have got to give, as a world community, as a global community, more attention to non-proliferation. Clearly, we do not need any more of these kinds of crises where we have looked away from the problem in DPRK for too long, and now we are confronting something where the hopes of the world is almost everyone's catching their breath as we wish well to the diplomats upon whom this burden has now dropped. There are ways to maintain a world with a non-proliferation as an ongoing issue, an ongoing effort by all of us, nuclear-armed and not nuclear-armed. In the case of the U.S., after we came out with our national defense strategy, we came out with a nuclear posture review, an NPR, something that, by the way, before I rolled it out, we went to a number of allies, more than two dozen allies, and briefed them ahead of time and took their ideas on board. Because these are this nuclear deterrent is probably the most, the heaviest issue that I deal with every day in this job. So what we want to do is, as we modernize to keep the nuclear deterrent safe and effective so those weapons are never used, we have to have a significant effort, collaborative effort with it, of non-proliferation as we try to reduce this scourge, and that's the only way you can describe nuclear weapons in this world. So we will work on this, and I think in the Indian Ocean, I think you bring up a good point. It's one of the areas we as a world need to give more attention to. How do we reduce the concerns of the countries there so they don't have to resort to a larger nuclear stockpile? And very quickly on India's role in Afghanistan, India is a South Asian nation. It is impacted by the aura of terrorism wherever it is, especially closer to home. And we know that India has been grievously attacked by terrorists in the past. They have a distinct, vital national interest in reducing the terrorism threat. As such, their impact in Afghanistan goes to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars of development money. And there are highways, there are schools, medical clinics. You'll notice there are no Indian troops on the ground. As they understand, there is a role for development here as they try to stay stabilizing without aggravating the concerns of the Pakistan government, of your country's government. So it's a difficult issue, but I think it's also one that India is operating in the best interests of the region and of the world as they try to help through development funds to remove the root causes of why young men pick up guns or listen to the lies of the terrorists, and then they get off once they start thinking in this direction. It is very difficult to bring them back to a civilized behavior. And so I like what India is doing there. I support it. I think we need more education and less fighting in the world. And I see India foremost in this effort in Afghanistan.
I've got about 14 people on the list. I'm just going to take two. Dr. Jeffrey Ordaniel from the Philippines.
You've mentioned South China Sea quite extensively in your speech, Mr. Secretary. So my question is related to the U.S.-Philippine alliance. Because in 2014, President Obama, when he was visiting Manila, was asked twice by a journalist if Philippine-occupied features and Filipino public vessels in the South China Sea are covered by the 1951 U.S.-Philippines Mutual Defense Treaty. And twice he sidelined the question. When Secretary Hillary Clinton was asked the same question, she said that she does not want to discuss hypothetical scenarios. But let me just ask the same question to you, Mr. Secretary, because I think the answer to this question is very important as to how the Duterte administration is going to move ahead with its own maritime security policy. So, in essence, the question is, are Filipino public vessels and Philippine-occupied features in the South China Sea covered by the 1951 U.S.-Philippines Mutual Defense Treaty? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. It's good to see someone without my color hair here, young man. I appreciate that. Let me tell you that when we have discussions on these matters, the reason why public figures do not want to give specific answers is that these are complex issues. And when you start saying yes, no, black, white, we have been on the record about international tribunals that say there is no such thing as a nine-dash line. There is no legal basis for this. We stand by international law. We stand by international tribunals. We listen to each nation's concerns. And to simply turn it into a military or non-military response is a shortchanging of the issue. This is what diplomacy is all about. Diplomacy is all about taking contrary perspectives and finding common ground. And we've got to try to do that in this world. those of us who have worn uniforms, those who wear uniforms today, are keenly aware of the cost of war. And there has got to be a commitment, not a, well, when it suits me, I'll listen to other nations. Not when it suits me, I'll listen to international tribunals. It's got to be that we actually want to live by these rules that have allowed China to recover many people from the depths of poverty and bring up their quality of life. These rules have helped China. There is a reason why China, I believe, will eventually come to grips with the needs and the expectations of the neighbors around it. And further, I would just tell you that we maintain confidentiality at times in these efforts. And I mean, it's a free and open press here, and I support that. But at the same time, you can often do most of your good work in setting the conditions for a path ahead by not locking yourself into public statements where, understandably, people take each word separately apart. And now pretty soon you're locked into positions that do not allow the diplomats to find common ground. So I'm not trying to give a civics class here. I just want you to understand why, in many cases, those who actually carry the responsibility do not go for it's my way or the highway or there's only one position. That would, might very well be a going-in position, and we stand by our treaty allies. But this is a discussion between the current administration in Manila and in Washington, D.C., and it's not one that can be answered as simply as your question would indicate.
And from Malaysia, Dr. Ningao Chow Bing.
Oops. Hello. Thank you very much, Mr. Secretary. So the recent National Security Strategy document and the National Defense Strategy document of the United States government have identified China and Russia as the main concerns and basically the strategic adversaries in the coming years. I assume this is the position. As I understand, for a long time, the U.S. strategy is try not to create a unified Eurasian bloc and try to drive a wedge between China and Russia. But now the documents seem to actually push them to work together even further. So is that really, wondering, is that really a wise move to put China and Russia and make them actually work much closer in these documents? Thank you.
Yeah, if that's what the documents appear to do, I've got to go back and read them again, because our view is that with both of those nations, with great power competition at levels that we had hoped would be characterized more by cooperation and collaboration, if the competition is going to grow more strident, then that's what we don't want to have happen. And in terms of their relationship, I think it's, from my review, it's objective fact that Russia has more in common with Western Europe and the United States than they have in common with China. I believe China has more in common with Pacific Ocean nations and the United States and India than they have in common with Russia. I think there's a natural non-convergence of interest. There may be short-term convergence in the event they want to contradict international tribunals or try muscling their way into certain circumstances. But my view, I would not be wasting my time going to Beijing at the end of the month if I really thought that's the only option between us and China. What would be the point of it? I've got more important things to do. I believe that what we're going to see is at some point in both Moscow and Beijing, they're going to recognize the reality of what we see in this room. Many different nations all sitting down together, all trying to find a way forward with respect for each other's internal dynamics, each other's cultures, and not finding this is a reason why we cannot work together. We all know we can work together. We have worked closely with Russia to defeat fascism, and with China to defeat fascism. We have worked closely with other nations that we had open war with Germany, with Japan after World War II. There is no need for this to go in the direction you're referring to of those two against the world. There are obviously a lot of nations allied with us. There's a lot of nations collaborating and partnering with us. But those nations and us combined have a desire for peace and figuring out how do we can find a way through these disagreements in a positive, productive relationship. It's competitive, certainly, but it does not have to be combative. And we all have to work hard at that. But I will go back and read the documents again after you go through it about 30 times before you sign it. You can sometimes start missing the forest for the trees. So thanks for bringing it up. I'll take a look at it. It's certainly not how we see the world.
In about 2 minutes, we will move immediately to the second plenary on the important issue of de-escalating the North Korean crisis. But I hope you will all agree with me that we have had just now a very clear statement from the U.S. Secretary of Defense and a tremendous conversation with the Secretary of Defense in command of the subject matter, the issues, the strategy, and its defense diplomatic execution. And please join me in thanking him for these 45 minutes.
He is, you can see why people enjoy listening to him. He is well thought, well spoken. His experience in warfighting and the respect that he garners around the world is something incredible to watch on an international stage. And let me tell you, and he was made for, he's a reader, a voracious reader. And the other thing he's mindful of, and I use the example of his transgender policy. He brings, for instance, when he got out and was off active duty before he did anything else, where did he could have gone anywhere, right? Where did he wind up? He wound up in at Stanford. Okay, Stanford is like Brainiac City, working on initiatives, and going there. So this statement about his intellectual bent, and he applies that intellectual rigor to everything he does. And so again, the transgender policy, you have the president tweeting the way he does, and then what did he do? He pushed back and said, we're going to do a study and we're going to do the right thing. There's not one part of him that is interested in doing partisan political shit. Not one. He understands the world as it is, but that's not, he believes in the nation. He believes in the greatness of the nation and he believes that he has a role in it and he's mindful of it. And so what did he do? They studied, and I believe that they did the exactly right thing relative to the transgender policy. To the extent that you can be a widget and you can pass our test, you can be employed as a member of the United States military. To the extent that you have physical requirements that would put you in the class, probably beyond the class of people affected by diabetes, people affected by asthma, we cannot use you. You are not a widget. And that is the nature of it. And I think that's altogether appropriate, and that's what he recommended to the President of the United States. And so you see all, that intellectual mind at work in the complex issues, and some of them are not so complex. Some of them it is, how do you get through them? And so I think the United States, in terms of what it's doing in the Pacific, is doing the right thing, which is tending to its alliances and on a very, very broad front pushing back on the Chinese. And we're doing the same thing after years and years of Barack Obama's poorly led and George Bush's neglect of the same organization. But, President Obama, seems to be a wonderful human being. Horrible president. Weak, horrible president. There's some headlines, and then I've got a couple emails I want to get to, and then I'll introduce you to Harris Holman. Our deficit with China, our merchandise deficit with China, has hit a record. All right. The U.S. merchandise trade deficit with China, as opposed to if you threw oil and other things in there, set a record through April, hitting $119 billion in the first 4 months of 2018. From January through April, the Census Bureau reports the United States exported $42.3 billion of goods to China, while it imported $161.3 billion. A little bit unequal? Yeah, a little bit. There's another story that the Obama administration that's been floated. The story is about Associated Press. The Obama administration, the Obama administration secretly sought to give Iran access, very briefly, to the U.S. financial system by sidestepping sanctions that had been kept in place after the 2015 nuclear deal, despite repeatedly telling Congress and the public that it had no plans to do so. I mean, seriously, what the hell? And what it was doing was it was converting, it was allowing banks, I want to say in the United Arab Emirates, to convert money held there into dollars so that it could be converted to euros. Yeah. And the United States was going to allow American financial institutions to be able to the Obama administration was going to allow access to American financial institutions in order to facilitate that. That money, right, the rest of the monies that we freed for them, we've seen where they've been used. Syria, Yemen, blah, 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 blah. Pretty amazing, though. There's already rumblings about the Department of Justice. I think a report that I think most Americans are curious to see, and that is, what does the DOJ, the Department of Justice Inspector General's report say about former FBI Director James Comey? There's a report out from ABC News that says the following. The Justice Department's internal watchdog has concluded that James Comey defied authority at times during his tenure as the FBI director. One source told ABC News that the draft report explicitly used the word insubordinate to describe Comey's behavior. Another source agreed that the characterization could not confirm the use of the term. Okay, now let me tell you, insubordinate, if you're doing the right thing, okay, is not wrong. So if you're being told by the Attorney General to do one thing and you think it's wrong, to be insubordinate to that is your moral obligation. So insubordinate is not necessarily an indictment of Comey. It depends what they cite he was insubordinate about. The draft also rebuked former Attorney General Loretta Lynch for her handling of the federal investigation into Hillary Clinton's personal email server. Again, these are people that swear an oath. Loretta Lynch, clown. So that evidently is supposed to come out. They said in the first couple weeks of June. So there's a number of stories that are rolling around out there that are it's troubling to say the least. And here's one more that again, it's time for some of these idiots to go away. And Rudy Giuliani is one of them. Okay. Headline in the Wall Street Journal. Kim Jong-un begged for summit, quote, on his hands and knees, Giuliani says. So Rudy Giuliani is in Israel for some reason, probably for some paid speaking engagement, okay? And so here's what the article says. Rudy Giuliani said North Korea leader Kim Jong-un got on his hands and knees and begged for their summit to be held after Mr. Trump canceled it last month. Mr. Giuliani counseled a similar approach to Trump administration negotiation with Palestinian officials in future Mideast peace process. Speaking at an investment conference in Israel hosted by the Globe's newspaper, Mr. Giuliani said Mr. Trump canceled the summit last month because senior North Korean officials insulted top Trump administration officials. Now, this, no, I mean, there's big, you know, there's big things at stake relative to the summit, and Giuliani's treating it like it's just a money-making adventure for him. I mean, it's, what an idiot. Again, so, like, again, why do we need age limits relative to participation in public events? Because you get idiots like him that roll out there and do and say stupid shit. It doesn't matter if it's true. So do you think there'll be some blowback from North Korea relative to this? Does it make the job easier or more difficult? Right? It's like Bolton signing in a very unfootnoted fashion, well, the model we want to follow is Libya. And he doesn't clarify the comments. Let me be very specific. Okay, we would like the disarmament piece to follow Libya, but unlike Libya, we don't seek any regime change, blah, blah. Hey, without the footnotes, it's just stupid. And now, and Giuliani, good God, man, shut your yap, you dumb. Anyway, I almost said a bad derogatory word for Italians. But because I've grown up, I didn't say that. The article goes on, quote, they also said they were going to nuclear war with us, and they were going to defeat us in a nuclear war, Mr. Giuliani said. Quote, we said we're not going to have a summit under those circumstances. After Mr. Trump canceled the meeting, Mr. Giuliani said, quote, well, Mr. Kim Jong-un got back on his hands and knees and begged for it, which is exactly the position you want him in. Like, what point, like, at what point do you realize that what you're saying is going to be counterproductive to what's in the best interest of the United States, which is to go and to go and negotiate. I don't know. It's just, the more I, that, again, what, Mac, why don't you comment so much about political news anymore? It's a shit show. It's an absolute shit show. And it's depressing. Because there's real people that have gone out and died and given their bodies and their lives, chunks of their body, for this democracy. And you have these idiots that somehow or other get elected and stay in office, you know, and it's just painful to watch. You know, it's painful to watch. And now as we start to flip over the rocks in Washington, D.C., what are we finding? We're finding it's more disgusting than we even think. So let me read you an email. Bubba Clinton. This is from Libby. Okay, he's out pushing a book he co-wrote with James Patterson. A look into his character, risking blowback from his disgraceful past conduct. Anything to make a buck. Honestly, I didn't listen to it. The TV was muted and he came up on it. And I want to say, he was on, John Stewart isn't on anymore, but he was on late night TV. I mean, the unmitigated gall of the guy to roll around like, and again, I've never apologized to her. Not unfootnoted that, look, legally I've been advised not to, you know, I realize what I did was awful. He's the poster child for it. How does he not apologize to a young woman who he exploited, kicked to the curb, and whose life he I won't say ruined, but it almost led to her suicide. Well, that's probably ruined. Ruined might not be a bad term. I mean, what a piece of shit. And I say that with as apologizing to every, you know, piece of shit out there. I'm sorry, but you're going to get lumped in with Bill Clinton. Hey, whoa, Mac. That's an insult to all of us people that are pieces of shit. Yeah, sorry, bro. You get him. He's a piece of shit. And if you're one, you should be pissed. You should be pissed. Well. No, it's just depressing, honestly. Like, I find more solace, and I'm not nearly as bothered by commanders getting relieved. You know, the tomfoolery that is the DOD and the Marine Corps. I find safety in there. To venture into the disgusting abyss of American politics, I don't want to get carried away much. To venture into the disgusting, shit-filled abyss, so there's a good question for you. An abyss is bottomless. How could it be shit-filled abyss? I don't know. Think about it. One of you Mensas asked, find Stephen Hawking. Communicate with Stephen Hawking, right? Put your metal helmet on with the electrodes coming out of it, right? Connect with Stephen Hawking and ask how we explain that. How does Mac reconcile the term shit-filled abyss? Well, abyss, bottomless, right? Bottomless infinity of shit. That's what American politics is. It's disgusting, right? Anyway, all right. We're going to take a break. And you're going to hear, on an inspirational note, it is June 6th. It is the 74th anniversary of what real Americans do. They act courageously. They act selflessly. That is our history. The history of Washington, D.C. is a national embarrassment to most of us. Okay? And unless you just focus on the fairy tales. If you just focus on the fairy tales, then it's all good. But if you focus on what's real in D.C., it's a joke. So, anyway, we'll focus on real Americans. On a real day in real American history. June 6, 1944, when Dwight Eisenhower launched the Day of All Days and the invasion of France that ultimately led to opening a second front in the war and expedited Germany's demise. All right, so we will go there. Trust me, the interview is awesome. Harris Holman, he landed at Normandy. You'll hear him. So, more of All Marine Radio on a Wednesday, hump day. Coming up next on your home for it, that would be the one and only All Warrior Radio Network, starting its third year this week. I've got to get Nielsen on. He's got to come on and talk about being an entrepreneur. If I can tell you, being an entrepreneur, it's overrated. If you're ready for a lot of anxiety in your life, right? There's easier. You can go to work for somebody and make it easy on yourself. Doing it by yourself. And I'm not very good at it either, but I stumbled along with the help of guys like Nielsen. More of All Marine Radio coming up next.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.